to me if I too happen. Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is May 7th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is One Thing, or Two Things, for Community-Acquired Pneumonia. And if we've got two things, we must have two guest skeptics today. And yes, we do. We have Victor Tsang, who's a fresh graduate from the University of Waterloo School of Pharmacy, and currently doing a residency at the London Health Science Center in London, Ontario. Victor apparently enjoys snowboarding and moonlit walks on the beach. Welcome to the SGEM, Victor. Do you like pina coladas and getting caught in the rain?
Pina coladas are pretty good, Ken. Caught in the rain, not so much.
Our next guest skeptic is Cassandra McEwen, and she graduated from McGill University and the University of Waterloo, and she's now also completing her one-year residency program at the London Health Science Center with Victor. Cassandra is counting down the days to summer sunshine and nights around the campfire. Welcome to the SGEM, Cassandra.
Glad to be here, Ken. We're longtime listeners and excited to be first-time participants.
Well, you know what? I'm amazed how enthusiastic EM pharmacists are about free open access to medical education. And there have been a number of EM Pharm experts on the SGEM this year.
We know. We've heard every one of them, and there are big shoes to fill here.
Yes, and those big shoes, they belong to Megan Groth. So, you know the format of the show? Fill in those shoes and give me a case scenario.
All right. It starts with a 62-year-old man who presents to your emergency department with a four-day history, sorry, Ken, not five, of increasing shortness of breath, purulent cough, fever, and generally feeling quite unwell. You measure his vitals, and he is mildly tachycardic and tachypneic, normotensive, and oxygen saturation at 96% on room air. His temperature is 38.2 degrees Celsius. For our American listeners out there, that's 100.7 degrees Fahrenheit.
You obtain routine blood work, including a lactate level and blood cultures. A chest x-ray reveals a left lower lobe infiltrate in his lungs, suggestive of pneumonia, and the decision is made to admit him to your general medicine floor. You are about to start him on empiric antibiotics and wonder whether to use beta-lactam monotherapy or beta-lactam plus macrolide combination therapy.
Well, I really like the case scenario that you've got, and I particularly like, Cassandra, the sound effects. Let's see if you can keep that up through the whole episode. But can you get to some background information on community-acquired pneumonia?
Of course, Ken. Community-acquired pneumonia is a common cause of emergency department visits and hospital admissions. Over the years, studies have looked at ways of scoring severity of illness to decide where a patient should be treated and how long a patient should receive antibiotics.
Well, I remember starting out and having to calculate the fine criteria to determine the severity and whether or not to admit a patient to hospital. Now, what we do is we just go to MD Calc and open up the PORT score, or Pneumonia Severity Index, PSI, app as a clinical decision tool to help us risk stratify patients for outpatient or inpatient management. And this man scored 92 or moderate risk based on his age, sex, tachycardia, and tachypnea.
There is still controversy surrounding what antibiotics should be our empiric go-to. This has been increasingly difficult to pinpoint given the rise of antimicrobial resistance. In a 10-year span, Canada saw a dramatic rise in macrolide-resistant Streptococcus pneumoniae from 3.7% to a whopping 19%. And we all know antimicrobial resistance is largely driven by overuse or misuse of antibiotics.
Well, all the more reason why we need the best evidence to select the best antibiotics for therapy for our community-acquired pneumonia patients. But what is the clinical question we're going to try to address on this edition of the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine?
Our question today is, in adult patients admitted to hospital with moderately severe community-acquired pneumonia, which is better at achieving clinical stability? Beta-lactam monotherapy or beta-lactam plus macrolide combination therapy? So bottom line, mono, or combo.
What's the reference for this?
And the reference that we will be using today was published in JAMA Internal Medicine 2014 by Guerin et al. It is titled Beta-lactam Monotherapy versus Beta-lactam Macrolide Combination Treatment in Moderately Severe Community-Acquired Pneumonia, a Randomized Non-Inferiority Trial.
You know that we go through the PICO, so what was the population?
Immunocompetent adults presenting to the emergency department with community-acquired pneumonia and who were subsequently hospitalized.
And the inclusion criteria?
Age greater than or equal to 18 years, greater than or equal to 2 clinical findings suggestive of pneumonia, and presence of new infiltrate on chest radiograph.
And their exclusion criteria were severe immunosuppression, recent hospitalization defined as within the last 14 days, residency in a nursing home, severe pneumonia as per the IDSA 2007 rule or PSI category 5, or administration of any antibiotic for greater than 24 hours before inclusion. Cassandra, what was the intervention?
So for monotherapy, options were cefuroxime 1.5 grams 3 times daily IV, followed by cefuroxime 500 milligrams twice daily by mouth.
Or amoxicillin clavulinic acid 1.2 grams 4 times daily IV, followed by amoxicillin clavulinic acid 625 milligrams 3 times daily by mouth.
And what did they compare this to?
Well, for the combo therapy, they used the monotherapy regimen plus clarithromycin 500 milligrams twice daily IV or by mouth.
And what was their primary outcome?
The primary outcome, Ken, was the percentage of patients not reaching clinical stability at day 7.
And so for listeners, what they did to define clinical stability was all 5 vital signs reached and maintained for a minimum of 24 hours. So their heart rate had to be less than 100, their systolic blood pressure greater than 90, their tympanic temperature less than 38 degrees Celsius, and their respiratory rate less than 24, and an O2 sat by pulse oximeter had to be greater than 90% on room air. How about secondary outcomes?
For the secondary outcomes, here's the laundry list. Intensive care unit admission, complicated pleural effusion, length of stay, change in initial antibiotic treatment, in-hospital death, 30-day mortality, 90-day mortality, 30-day readmission, 90-day readmission, and new pneumonia within 30 days.
That is a hospital laundry list. So the author's conclusions were, quote, beta-lactam monotherapy was not found to be non-inferior to beta-lactam plus macrolide combination therapy in hospitalized adult patients with moderately severe community-acquired pneumonia. However, patients infected with atypical pathogens or with PSI Category 4 pneumonia had delayed clinical stability with monotherapy based on secondary outcome analysis. Well, guys, we're going to go through the checklist for this type of trial, and why don't you guys just go back and forth with this? So I will throw out some questions, and you provide the answers. Sound good?
Sounds great.
All right, question number one. The study population included, was it focused on those in the emergency department?
Yes. All patients presented initially to the emergency department, Ken.
Question two. The patients, were they adequately randomized?
Yes. Quote, computer-generated and stratified by center with a 1-to-1 ratio in randomly alternating blocks of 6, 8, and 10, end quote.
Question three, the randomization process, was it concealed?
Yes, it was, Ken. The patients were allocated to treatment arms by means of consecutive, numbered, sealed, and opaque envelopes.
The patients, were they analyzed in the groups which they were randomized?
Yes, they were. Quote, all analyses were performed in the intention to treat populations, end quote.
And Victor, important to note here, even in patients who ended up receiving a macrolide in the monotherapy group due to a positive Legionella urine test, they still did intention to treat analysis, which as skeptics, we're happy to see.
Oh, we are happy to see. And now question five, the study patients, were they recruited consecutively?
Yes, indeed they were.
Question six, the patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
This is a tough one, Ken, but I'm going to have to give them an almost. Now, Legionella was more common in the monotherapy group, occurring in 4.1% of patients versus only 1.4% in the combination group. This could mean the monotherapy group were less likely to achieve clinical stability.
Well, were all participants, the patients, the clinicians, outcome assessors, were they all unaware of the group allocation?
No. Patients and clinicians were aware of allocation.
However, the two separate outcome assessors were blinded to treatment allocation, and the primary outcome was objective, so should not be vulnerable to bias anyways.
Question 8, all groups, were they treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes, as far as we know, Ken.
Was the follow-up complete, at least 80% for both groups?
This was a resounding yes. There was 100% follow-up at day 30. Follow-up was done by phone if patients were discharged before then.
Question 10, all patient important outcomes were considered.
We're on the fence. This one's a maybe. Vital signs indicating clinical stability are technically surrogate outcomes. Ideal primary outcomes would have been clinical cure, hospital readmission, mortality or length of stay.
And the final question, question number 11, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No, it wasn't. The upper limit of the one-sided 90% confidence interval was 13%, exceeding the predefined non-inferiority boundary of 8%. Dun, dun, dun.
Keep in mind that the FDA recommends using a non-inferiority boundary of 10% for assessing clinical success of a new anti-infectious treatment. So the trial investigator setting it at a conservative 8% showed good intentions a priori.
Well, let's go through some of those key results in a bit more detail. They had a total of 580 patients included in the analysis, with 291 receiving monotherapy and 289 receiving combination treatment.
So for the primary outcome, which remember was patients not reaching clinical stability at day 7, 41.2% in the monotherapy group did not reach clinical stability at day 7 versus 33.6% in the combo group. This gives us an absolute risk reduction of 7.6%, translating to a number needed to treat of 14.
For secondary outcomes, that is mortality, complications, intensive care unit admission, length of stay, and recurrence of pneumonia within 90 days, they found no difference for any of them. They also did some subgroup analyses and found combination therapy was better for atypical pathogens and pneumonia severity index category 4 patients, whereas monotherapy patients were more likely to be readmitted in 30 days.
All right, so that covers the results section. Now it's time to talk a little nerdy. Victor?
Well, in our opinion, the study was designed well with good internal validity and a primary outcome that was patient-oriented. The timing of patient follow-up does make sense, and not many patients were lost to follow-up. In addition, the data analysis was a true intention-to-treat analysis.
Even though the absolute difference was 7.6%, the upper limit of the 90% confidence interval was 13%. Since it is above the a priori non-inferiority boundary of 8%, non-inferiority of monotherapy was not demonstrated. There was some threats to validity, though. The study was supposed to target patients with moderately severe community-acquired pneumonia, but they actually accepted all CAP patients. This was evident by their PSI scores. They had 10% in Category 1, 50% in that Category 2 and 3, and 40% were Category 4. So the study artificially met its power because it accepted patients that were both mild as well as severe.
As such, the external validity of the results is not very clear, because to which community-acquired pneumonia patients do we apply this to then?
And it is important to note that there was more Legionella, which you mentioned earlier, randomized to the monotherapy group. Legionella predisposes patients to be sicker, and this imbalance at baseline could have contributed to the monotherapy being seen as less effective.
Another limitation of this study was the antibiotics used are not available in Canada. So IV amoxicillin clavulinic acid and IV cefuroxime are not available in Canada. Also, we usually use azithromycin rather than clarithromycin as our macrolide of choice in community-acquired pneumonia.
Well, the study was conducted across multiple sites. All the sites were in Switzerland, and we need to consider the difference in antimicrobial resistant patterns compared to our own country. Ideally, we'd like to see a similar study done in Canada.
We actually contacted the authors and had them send us their antibiogram, which we compared to our own, and surprisingly, the patterns were quite similar.
Nicely done, Cassandra, reaching out and actually contacting them about their antibiogram. Nicely done.
One final thing to comment upon was that there were no safety differences between the two arms, which is very reassuring for us.
All right, so now it's the point where I'd like to compare the authors' conclusions to the conclusions we came up with.
So the authors' conclusions are similar to our SGEM conclusion. The evidence shows beta-lactam monotherapy is not non-inferior to beta-lactam plus macrolide combo therapy in admitted community-acquired pneumonia patients. As such, this data reaffirms our current practice, which is to use beta-lactam plus macrolide as empiric therapy in admitted community-acquired pneumonia patients.
And you know, I hesitate to make the same conclusions that the authors made regarding secondary outcomes due to issues with proper powering. How about a bottom line, Victor? Can you bring this home? What's the SGEM bottom line?
So the SGEM bottom line is that in patients presenting to the emergency department with community-acquired pneumonia severe enough to warrant admission, we should continue to use beta-lactam plus macrolide as our choice of empiric therapy.
All right, so how are you going to resolve the case?
You decide to start the patient empirically on ceftriaxone IV plus oral azithromycin. 2 days later, his blood cultures come back showing strep pneumoniae is sensitive to cefuroxime.
At this point, he has improved clinically. Heart rate, systolic blood pressure, and respiratory rate are all within the normal range, and his fever has abated. You make the decision to write him a script for cefuroxime to complete his course of antibiotics and discharge him home.
So how are you going to take this information and apply it clinically?
Well, according to the Ontario Anti-Infective Guidelines for Community-Acquired Infections, which is an evidence-based, peer-reviewed publication, community-acquired pneumonia is divided into three categories: mild to moderate, severe requiring hospitalization, and finally, severe requiring intensive care unit.
Notice how none of these categories align 100% with the article's moderately severe community-acquired pneumonia. You can't see it, but I'm making air quotes with my fingers. Recommended empiric therapies also differ. Beta-lactam monotherapy is only recommended for mild to moderate community-acquired pneumonia patients who can be safely treated as outpatients.
Once admitted, the only monotherapy recommended is a fluoroquinolone. However, at our hospital, we're trying to decrease its use as our antibiogram shows increasing resistance to fluoroquinolones, and also because it's associated with higher risk of Clostridium difficile infections compared to other options.
So, for our community-acquired pneumonia patients sick enough to be admitted, we empirically use beta-lactam plus macrolide, which is supported by the results of this study.
So here's how I take this information and talk to my patient. I would let them know that they have community-acquired pneumonia, and we're going to admit them to hospital for treatment. They'd be informed that they are going to be started on two different antibiotics to treat the infection, one oral and one intravenous. We'd keep a close eye on them and hope to see some improvement in the next 24 to 48 hours. I would let them know that there are some further blood tests that had been taken that may show us how to better treat the pneumonia, but it'll take a few days to get the final results. Now, usually there's some fabulous music here that announces the Keener contest. But before I do that, I want to mention that another article came out on community-acquired pneumonia. It was by Postman et al., and it was published April 2nd in the New England Journal of Medicine.
It was a non-inferiority trial of beta-lactam monotherapy versus beta-lactam plus macrolide combination therapy versus fluoroquinolone monotherapy. Their primary outcome was 90-day mortality in an intention-to-treat analysis using a non-inferiority margin of 3% and a two-sided 90% confidence interval.
And, Cassandra, what was the conclusion?
Among patients with clinically suspected community-acquired pneumonia admitted to non-intensive care wards, a strategy of preferred empiric treatment with a beta-lactam monotherapy was, drumroll please, non-inferior to strategies with a beta-lactam plus macrolide combination or fluoroquinolone monotherapy with regard to 90-day mortality.
So really what they're saying is their primary outcome of non-inferiority for mortality, this agrees with the secondary outcome of the study we just showed, that no mortality difference. But we'll have to put our skeptical eye upon this paper in a future episode of the SJEM. Yes, even a skeptical eye on the New England Journal of Medicine. Okay, there's the sound. It's time for the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Brenda Pulsa. Brenda is an emergency medicine nurse at South Huron Hospital. She's one of the best, one of the brightest, most skilled nurses I have had the pleasure to work with. She has a razor-sharp wit, a heart of gold, and always keeps me in line. She knew the A, B, and C lines we talk about on chest x-rays were named after Dr. Curley, a radiologist who was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II. Do you have a Keener question for me this week?
All right, listeners. Erythromycin was discovered in the 1950s and developed as the first macrolide. From what was it isolated?
And how about for a bonus? Name the specific bacterium. Ooh.
Tell you what. If somebody gets the Keener contest plus the bonus question, I will send them the DS, the double strength cool skeptical prize. Send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener in the subject line, and you may win that double strength cool skeptical prize. Well, when this podcast goes up, I'll be in final preparation for the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians meeting in Edmonton. Yes, we will be lighting the way May 30th to June 3rd. And then later in the month, it will be the Social Media and Critical Care meeting. Smack! Chicago, June 23rd to 26th. I can't wait to catch a baseball game, eat some Chicago popcorn, and go for a smack run with all my FOMED friends. Thank you, Victor and Cassandra, for being on the SGEM. It is great to finally have some Canadian EM farm people on the program.
It was our pleasure.
Thanks for having us on the show, Ken.
I'll tell you what, can you guys give the SGEM tagline in stereo?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.